Chaos. Woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, chilling with coffee mugs, me and coffee chugs, talking education all across the nation, pushing boundaries, thinking innovation. Chaos.
Hello everyone, how you doing? Welcome to another episode of Living on the Edge of Chaos podcast. Man, I'm really, really, really excited for this conversation on a lot of levels. One, this is somebody who has had huge impacts on work that I've been able to do in classrooms, and I've seen her work directly impact the thinking, the depth of understanding the world, and even the independent minds of students and teachers, as this guest here has helped on some really cool classroom projects where we've published some graphic novels, and just her perspective to help us think through things that, quite frankly, not being in the industry, we would have no idea how to even think through that. I also highly respect this individual for just in general, her thoughts that she brings even outside of the projects, and her willingness to share and help and just humanity in general. And we get to do this from while she's across the pond. And so today I'm here with my friend Claire, who we haven't had a chance to talk in quite some time since the last time we've been able to connect on a classroom project. But we're here not just to talk education, but I think something that's really important as we start to grapple AI, maybe not always AI, but AI is the hot ticket item, thinking about creativity and humanity. And so I'm already getting ahead of myself as we were talking before the show, and I'm already assuming that everyone knows this. So Claire, before we get into the fun, let's start off with letting people know who you are. So Claire, who are you? What do you do? And what in the world do you got going on?
Well, I'm Claire Napier. I have kind of a three-prong practice. I began as a comics critic. I became a comics editor, and I'm also a cartoonist, because who can resist? The way that I know Aaron is, as you said, he invited me to be involved in some classroom projects that he had going. I've done that for the past 2 years, and it's brilliant. It's really good fun. It's great to have, you know, real life impact on on real living real living people. Most of the time I work at home on my own, so though I am working directly with creators, with people making their own comics, it's nice to branch out and to reach, you know, a little more of humanity. It's always a goal with comics at large. I mean, comics are a communication item. They're art, but they're also talk. They're reaching out and trying to reach somebody else. So being able to do that through the work and also in the immediate sense is lovely.
It is. And so, you know, before we get into talking about the creatives and what that means, you know, I've been asking a guest, just as you can see my backdrop here, all my little Spider-Man figurines and Lego builds. You know, I am a comic. A comic nerd. I'm not going to say I'm an expert, because there are people that are way beyond my intelligence as I've been getting involved in it the last couple of years. But I am curious about kind of your origin story, taking the comic approach here. And so you work in the comic industry as an editor, the critic, and all the different hats you wear. So let's maybe start there. Like, how did you get to this world? How did you know, like, this is where, I don't know if it's your passion, I'm assuming it is. It's the work you do. I see what you follow and see what you share, and I can feel that energy. But talk a little bit about how you got in there, because not everybody gets to live a world of comics, and maybe some people haven't even held a comic in their hands. So there's that too. And so I want to set the stage for that, because what I love about the podcast is bringing in so many different perspectives, and you have what I love is, you've been able to see the impact in the classroom, but you're doing it kind of, even though you are an educator, through that lens, but also on the outside, like not directly involved in schools. And so how did you fall into the pathway of comics?
Well, to begin at the beginning, actually, no, I'm going to answer something else that you said, in there while you were speaking. You said that maybe some people haven't held a comic in their hands. I think that's probably wrong. I think that, I mean, they may not have held an American monthly, like 9x11-inch single issue comic. That's probably fair to say many people haven't, because you have to go these days to a specialty shop if you do it on purpose. Although I believe they are coming back to like the supermarkets here and there. But anyway, but everybody's probably held a newspaper. Whether or not it's like a big broadsheet or a tabloid or just like a local weekly, there's usually going to be a comic strip in there. I think everyone probably is familiar with the format of comics, whether it's very, very short or long. I mean, even if they don't have a syndicated strip like Peanuts, for example, or we have Nemi here, or Flash Gordon, Prince Valiant, there's so many different syndicated strips that a lot of people recognize. Even if the paper that you're holding doesn't have one of those, they probably will have a political cartoon or two, which is just a one panel comic. So I think that everyone recognizes comics, but not everyone recognizes themselves as a comics reader. Like people in my own family will say to me, I don't know how to read comics. At some degree, I'm sympathetic to that, because when you think that you don't know how to do something, doing it is intimidating. But it's just a matter of trying and not assuming that you can't do it, which is it's true of basically anything. Like, learning how to do something is just a matter of not being afraid to have a go. To answer the actual question.
Well, I love that. Yeah. I mean, I just think it's already like, this is why I love talking to you, that shifting of perspective as you answer that. I'm like, yeah, you're right. People have, because I was thinking of the tangible comic, you know, as I found my local comic shop and, you know, I've got a pull list. I feel so special, you know, that's what I'm thinking, but you're still spot on. And we have. So I'm already excited that we're having this conversation.
But that's great. Ahead.
Okay. Now origin story here.
So when I was a child, like a full on small human being, once I was ill and my mum was ill at the same time, and my dad came home one day and he brought Cosmopolitan for my mum, and he brought a magazine for me as well, and he brought me Bunty, which was in Britain in the last century now. It was very, very common to have weekly comics magazines for children, like the Beano, the Dandy, 2000 AD, the only one really that's left still going. The Phoenix has come back, but that wasn't an old one. And Bunty was one of the ones for girls. There used to be many, many, many different titles. There was Jinty, there was Misty, there was Patches and Blue Jeans and My Guy. Like, these were magazines that had a lot of comics in, to a greater or lesser degree. Like, they were... It wasn't the kind of being a comics reader that we think of today, looking at the American US market, where you go in every month and you get one whole issue of one whole story. It was usually between 1 and 6 pages, like a chapter essentially every week, of various different strips. There might be a lot of strips and then 1 or 2 other features, like the letters page and a quiz and a poster. Or it might be the kind of magazine where it's mostly magazine content and then 1 or 2 comic strips. It varied a lot, but in that way, pretty much everyone grew up being a comics reader. It's just that because they weren't categorized as comics per se, it was just something in the magazine. Almost no one here thinks of themselves as a comics reader in the same way that we've just been talking about. So even though I read Bunty for quite a lot of years, and also read comics in the other like young girls magazines, I was reading like Girl Talk, which had a Sweet Valley Twins photo story. I forgot about it as soon as I was aging out of those magazines. I did, because I didn't think I'd been reading comics. I just thought I'd been reading things for children, and now I'm a bit older and I want to read things for teenagers. So there was a gap in my readership. And then when I was old enough to go online on my own, I found people who cared about the X-Men, which I watched on the television as a child. I didn't associate that with comics either, because to me it was a cartoon and I didn't have any reason to think of those as even related to each other.
Sure.
But they were interested in the X-Men comic books. So I sort of discovered that this was a thing that existed, the American format, the monthly format. And I found a local shop in my local town, a specialty comic shop where I could get a hold of those American comic books. So I started reading again when I was about 15. And the combination of being online, reading comic books, you can't really be involved in fan spaces online without writing. Again, this is probably usually something that we don't think of as writing because it's just talking to people, but it is writing. And through that, I developed much more, in fact, than I did through my school English lessons, the ability to write analysis and to analyze a text and to think about like inference and just a critical vocabulary and a critical mind and the opinion that it was fun to be critical and interested in the literary object of comic book. So I met a lot of people, like making friends on online communities, communicating in this fashion. And eventually that led to comics.com, which some of us came together to form, because at the time a lot of the commentary, the discourse was dominated by not women, and it was quite a hostile scene. So it was a statement, no, we talk about it. Stop saying we don't, stop saying, oh, if only a girl would ever say something about a comic book. It's boring, it's silly, it's happening. And we developed that website into a magazine, essentially, a magazine site full of critical writing, reviews, features, interviews, things like that, around the features editorial for, I think, 6 years. Then I was editor-in-chief there for a while. And then when I gave that up, because that was all for free, that was just work for nothing, volunteer stuff, essentially, but we were running it like a real concern, like a real business, essentially. So it was taking up all of my time, and eventually I just couldn't do it anymore.
Right.
It's still running. Like, you should visit that website and read some stuff. It's won several Eisner Awards. But yeah, when I had finished there, I thought, what can I do next? And it seemed quite obvious that the answer would be editorial, because when you look at a lot of comics, or at least for me, of this particular critical bent, of a certain amount of curiosity and process-based interest, when you have the same things to say about books quite often, like, I wish this had been more developed in this direction, I wish this dialogue was a little more original, I wish these relationships had been developed, I wish blah, 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 you start to think, well, why can't I tell people this before it's finished, before it's published? Why shouldn't I let them know what isn't shining as brightly as it could be, so that they can make sure that it gets polished up, so that the people who are reading it are going to be satisfied in a way that I'm finding myself unsatisfied. So I put out the word, I'm going to do this, and some people were like, can you do it for me? And I never looked back.
I love that. And as
you
you're
do, actually.
Yeah. So as you're sharing that, thanks for sharing that story. I learned some things I didn't know about you, which is awesome. So I know you have this wonderful superpower of being able to critique and analyze and give feedback where it's thoughtful and it's helpful. And like you said, to help, how do we, in that process, I'm thinking of learning in education where so often, I shouldn't say so often, that's not really fair, but there are times where a kid might turn in an assignment and there's no feedback along the way, you know, and then at the end they get their paper back and it's all marked up, you know, I'm thinking maybe more of my own education journey, all with all the red ink all over. And it's like, well, yeah, that would have been nice to know maybe before I turned in the final piece. So that process over product, I think, resonates a lot in the education space. As you are applying those skills and you're continuing to work in that field, I want to expand a little bit about that arena. And why do you feel that, like, it's not just creativity, it's so much more. You talk about the power of communication, but the visual arts, the power of storytelling, the ability to convey ideas maybe in new ways that resonates with people, and your work is helping the people that are trying to do that become better at that. But why that space? Why is that so important? Especially, I would say, in this day and age, more than ever before, and for probably a lot of reasons that I can probably find researcher support, maybe more opinion than anything, but you know, you've gravitated to this space, you continue to work in this space. Why is this so important? And then we'll start to leverage in why it's important we don't lose sight of that. But I think that's a really important element that I want to unpack with you.
Well, not to be too dramatic, but not doing that kind of makes me want to die.
Mm.
I don't know how not to do it.
Yeah.
Without becoming intensely miserable to the point of non-functionality, practically. Yeah. It's a hard question to answer because from my perspective, and I don't mean this really as a criticism of the question.
No, right.
But it's because it's kind of a stupid question.
Yeah, right.
To my, like, I don't know how else to live.
Yeah.
I just don't. I'm not good at other jobs. and I don't know how to get them. I've been unemployed. Trying to gain a normal job. I don't know how to do it. I'm not successful at it. And I don't especially want to be. But it's not that I wasn't trying out of disdain. It's just I just don't know how to do it. I don't know how to turn off the my mind thinks like this on its own.
Mm.
Like people, it's fairly common, or it was fairly common in the 2010s for people to respond to, for example, film criticism with just turn off your brain and watch it. And I can't do that, which is probably related to ADHD, but I don't know that is particularly meaningful in the practical sense, because it simply is the circumstance, it's the situation. I can't not think it's a shame they didn't develop that part of the plot, and I see what they were going for here, but it hasn't really come through, and with a few more developmental passes it really could have. And that particular style of lighting is so gorgeous, and it really brings out the themes of the scene. Like I can't not be this.
Right.
So I don't understand trying. I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, I love that answer on a couple fronts. One, to me, it is a stupid question in the sense that, like, because I feel like, and here's why that I would agree with that, is I think so much of our day-to-day life, the things that we do, the things we gravitate to, whether it doesn't matter our job or occupation, hobbies, interests, I think we've taken for granted the power of the visuals, of the storytelling, whether that is in a comic or a graphic novel, whether that's movies, TV shows, whether that's your short little TikToks that I see, like my own children glued to it. Like the power of visual storytelling is so prevalent in all aspects of our life that I think we don't always take time to appreciate the creative energy that comes with that. And so with that is stacked upon there, then there also needs to be, I don't want to call it guardrails because that's not the right word, but like people that can offer critique and feedback and think through that. For example, I posted the other day on social media, and maybe this will resonate a little bit, where like I posed, there are times where I watch TV shows or movies, not because I necessarily want to watch a TV show or a movie, but I'm more excited about the podcast people that I like to listen to hear their commentary, their theories, their critiques. And they help me see things in shows, in movies, which then I think translate to helping me see the world in ways that, like, I was like, oh, I didn't even pay attention to this little tiny detail. And now I find myself looking for those, and not just in shows, but in life, and appreciating different kind of aspects. So I'm kind of rambling here, but I guess what I'm trying to do is like I agree with you. And I think part of that is coming back to kind of what I wanted to bring out through the question is like, that we don't lose sight of that, like, because I think so much of it does go underappreciated. We don't always appreciate the energy it takes to create something to put out into the world. We also don't always, we overlook what it takes to be able to look at that and give feedback and be able to engage that. That's what helps move the mediums forward. You know, and that to me is the exciting element of living. Like, you can't just be looking at spreadsheets all the time or whatever your job might be. Like, there's more to life than that.
Yeah, the something that I think is very easy to I suppose forget or just not notice or realize is that it's sort of immutable. Is you have to do something with your time. Like, we are alive for as long as we're alive, but while we're alive, we are alive all the time. And the more things that are automated, the more time that leaves over. And, like, it is nice to not have to do manual labor all the time, if you are lucky enough not to have to do manual labor all the time. But while you're not doing whatever thing you don't want to do, you're doing something else because you're still existing. Like, if, for example, like a silly example, if you get your sibling to do the washing up for you, even though it's your chore, what are you doing in the time that they are washing up? It's something. Like, even if it's nothing, even if it's just sitting with your feet up, that is what you're doing. And there's a sort of essentially endless quality to that state, because until you die, you're doing something all the time. And boredom is a real thing. It does afflict us. It can. It doesn't have to, but if you don't do anything ever, it will. So if you can find diverting things to do or think or look at, if you can find something to stimulate you while you are in that constant state of existence, then it will be nicer. You'll have a nicer time. If you just sit in a very boring room thinking about nothing, do you want to be doing that? Like, right. Do you forever? Forever? If it's scary to do things badly. It absolutely is. But it's more interesting than not, than doing nothing, than sitting and waiting for someone else to do it for you, sitting and waiting for someone else to do it perfectly. There's always you experiencing the passage of time. And making that fun by giving yourself things to develop, whether it be practically, like by drawing or doodling or writing things down, or even like developing a spreadsheet of things that you are particularly interested in, or if it's just mental, like you're just thinking, what could my character do next? What would someone like that do in a situation like this? It's more interesting than not. It's more interesting than just looking at a spot on the wall. I think that because we are alive, we may as well enjoy it. And I think it's quite easy if you let yourself. If you let yourself enjoy it, that's just better, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. No, I agree. And sometimes I feel, I mean, I've used this word a lot in a lot of the recent podcasts I've been recording, but the word's permission. And so much of us, we don't give ourselves permission, in this case, maybe to enjoy life and have fun. We get so caught up in work, and that could be easy, where you can work. I was actually just messaging a friend, and they've been putting in some crazy hours. And then I said, you know what? You need to at, you know, 5 p.m. or whatever the time it was that I referenced, need to be done. Because guess what? You could work literally through the night. And you know what the next day, you know what's going to be there? Work. Or you could turn off and that work will still be there tomorrow. And life and society and everything will move on. Now, don't get me wrong. There are times and places of deadlines and certain things that do require extra effort. But we can get caught up in that. We can get caught up in things that, the busyness is what a lot of what I've been reading about to maybe avoid or you know, we don't, maybe we don't even know what that looks like to enjoy. Like, we don't, do we know ourselves? So we're getting real meta here, which is always seems to happen when I chat with you, but I think it's so spot on. I think as you're talking through that, I'm like, how many of us just don't give ourselves permission to just go enjoy and go have fun? Why not go to the art gallery? Why not go to a movie? Why not take a walk? Why not? Like, that's because, like you said, you know, we're only alive while we're alive, and and tomorrow is definitely not ever promised.
It's very it is moralized. Like, it's a lot of the time, I think, that we don't do this, we don't give ourselves permission because we don't feel that we have permission from society at large. Especially, I think, well, perhaps not, but perhaps, especially if we have a religious background, or if we have a particular, like, some type, for example, people talk about the British stiff upper lip, for example, and to lesser or greater extent, there's truth in it, the idea that to not complain is good, is moral, is correct, to just get on with things, good, moral, correct. And it's very subconscious, it insinuates itself and you don't notice, unless you check, am I disallowing myself a completely harmless pleasure, like getting a cup of coffee or sitting on the grass with my bare feet or having a stroll down to see my favorite flower while it's out, just because I haven't thought about my assumption of morality, and my assumption of morality is telling me that I must prioritize my work day over 15 seconds walking to see the flower, or I must prioritize making dinner for my husband over making like a nice drink for myself so that I feel happy before I begin, or like, it's just, it's very, very easy to forget that there are all kinds of messages and very subtle communications that we pick up all the time, if we don't take care to notice on purpose and to do sort of an internal checklist, like, am I bumming myself out just because I've forgotten to stop? It really does happen very, very easily. But I think that if there's one responsibility that a human being has, it's to keep themselves as, I'm trying to think of a word that doesn't over-moralize, but just to keep your life as non-depressing, I guess, as possible. If you have a choice, make the one that's nicer for you, as long as it's not, you know, stabbing someone. Right. Why would it be? Why would it be? Like, it's tricky in discussions like this to sound casual and to have the confidence that a listener won't over extrapolate.
Sure.
Like, I would like to just say, take it easy and have a nice time without assuming that someone may imagine that means run amok and throw mud in someone's eyes.
Right.
It doesn't, obviously.
Right.
But subliminal communication all the time, you know, be suspicious, watch out, discourse, yada yada. It's tiresome. So yeah, just have a nice time. Decide to have a nice time and take care of yourself. It's tricky to start with, but it's very useful.
Yeah.
It's very useful to living.
It is. No, I think you're spot on, and you're right. You know, like, when we are kind of having this conversation, you know, kind of feels like into the void, where anybody can take the words in any direction, you know, but I think you're right. I mean, even this week, my kind of like weekly motto has been lots of stuff happening at the time of this recording with my job and just things in general. And I've just been the phrase of like, let go. And the focus has been more on just, not like let go, who cares, don't care about anything, but the idea of like, what are the things that I can control? And let's focus on controlling those and doing the things that will help me feel better. Doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to feel happier, but I'm going to feel just better about who I am. And so, like, this week, I just been taking time, and it has to be, I mean, this is me, like, I have to, like, put my actions where my words are. Like, I have to, like, I've been dedicating time where, like, I go in the morning and I've been going down to the local comic shop just to try to build some just other routines. And I've been like buying tangible comics because, I mean, people that can't see, but if I have my phone, like I subscribe to some, like, the Marvel and the DC and Shonen and those things, but I was like, but my phone keeps going off, so I'm not really ever really immersing in a story. And so, like, I want to be unplugged. And so now I'm like, okay, I'm gonna read, you know, like 3 comics a day just to build a habit where I'm sitting, no devices, and I love it. And it's taken time because I also feel like I should be checking my phone, and I'm like, why? Like, it's nothing is that detrimental. And so but it's just building that space and capacity and the habit, right? Like, I can sit absolutely here. This is going to take 20 minutes. This is not going to take endless hours. I can still be responsible parents and professional and all the things, but I can do this, and I love it. I love the paper in my hands, and I'm getting to that space. But at first it's like, boy, this is a sign that it's a problem, that I feel like I'm anxious, that I'm not, you know, that my phone isn't buzzing or whatever the thing might be. It's just a really fascinating kind of, I don't know, experiment that I'm trying to run, like, to kind of recalibrate back to, like, do the things you enjoy. I'm in my own way. Like, I'm not blaming
yes,
people.
Exactly.
I am literally the barrier that's keeping me from doing some of that.
I read a newsletter from my friend Cecilia O'Mara the other day, and I want to read a little bit of that because it's actually really relevant to what we're talking about. She's talking about the book The New Me by Hallie Butler, which she didn't like. But she says, what stands out the most to me in my memory of The New Me, where she describes the grubby brown towels in her apartment, which she hates but hasn't replaced. And when I think about it now, I think, yes, the towels are actually the problem. This is the best line. You will never gain control of your life until you act to control your life. And the very first thing she could do is replace the brown towels. It's completely true.
Yeah.
I've found the same thing. And it's real. Like, it's real. It really does happen that way. If you abdicate responsibility to yourself, who is going to catch you? No one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I love that. Yeah. I mean, it's so true. And I think all of us could relate to the brown towel, right? Like, I think we all probably have our own version of a brown towel, you know, in our own space. Just as you think through that. Yeah. It's, again, it's those details, right? It's the things that maybe we're not noticing or looking at or intentionally or maybe subconsciously ignoring, because it's just kind of like an onion peeling back the layers as we go through. So, gosh, this is so good. So as we think about this, I'm going back then to the idea of storytelling, enjoying life. You love critiquing and editing and giving feedback to comics and graphic novels, things of that nature. Not to go through all the elements, but I am curious for people who maybe don't do that, or maybe haven't thought about that. And not that it has to necessarily be, and I'm thinking for the listener, that you have to, like, go buy a comic to do these things. But I am curious, just as perspective, like, as we watch TV shows or movies, that's probably where most people are. You know, as you're looking through that with that lens of yours that you love, that you said, you know, you almost can't turn off, and it's your dopamine hit. You know, how do you, because you have such this conversation is proof of that, such a awesome perspective of seeing things and analyzing things. What's kind of your process as you're going through those things, as you're looking at, you know, someone gives you their work that they're doing? You know, and the reason I'm asking this is, the listener, I'm going to challenge you then, kind of whatever here is, to tweak it and remix it and apply it to your own kind of practice or life or entertainment, or, you know, not you have to do it all the time, but whatever your mode of medium is. But for you, you're looking through that, you know, what's some of, like, the questions or ponderings or things that you have?
Well,
I know that's
really
general for probably for some very specific tasks.
No,
so
I have an ebook actually, called, I can't remember the title. I think it's called How to Be a Comics Critic. Mm. Because there's always talk about whether or not people are doing it right or whether or not people know how to do it and blah, blah, blah. And it's silly. But because some people don't feel that they know how to do it, I made an ebook taking you through the essential steps. But I can summarize it because it's essentially just pay attention to what you notice. Once you notice what you notice, you can ask yourself, what do I think about that? What does it mean? What might it mean? How does it relate to other things that I've noticed about it or that I know about it? Give me an example of the thing. Like a piece of media.
Let's just go with like a general like Spider-Man comic. How about that?
Okay.
So here's your scenario, and we can clean this little brainstorm piece out. So
sure.
If I present you, like, at the time of this recording, I know that tomorrow, the next issue of one of my Spider-Man series is going to be on the rack, or in my pull list, I should say. You know, if I wanted to take a look through that and kind of lend that eye that you put into the work, you know, what would be some things that I should be paying attention to notice or wonder about?
Okay, so Spider-Man. First of all, what does he wear? I would look at the book and I would ask myself, what is the main character wearing? And half the time it's probably going to be his costume. So I would say, what about the costume tells me something about the person? Or his experience. For example, Spider-Man's costume is always absolutely skin tight. Mm-hmm. Why is it? Because he's always swinging around. It's to reduce friction. It's to reduce the possibility he might be caught on a flagpole or something. And it's to allow us to have an uninhibited view of his gymnastic nonsense. You could look at what colors are used and how those make you feel. You could look at exactly what kind of gymnastic nonsense he's doing and how that makes you feel. You could look at how the artist of that particular issue is drawing the costume on his body, how many of the contours of his body, what kind of body he has, how that's being represented, what you think that means about what Marvel as a whole thinks that the idea of people who read Spider-Man expect or allow in regards to how naked he looks, essentially. Because, for example, my partner has been reading Spider-Man recently, and it goes backwards and forwards with the artist. Which parts of Spider-Man's body are most clearly outlined? Which angles we're seeing Spider-Man from? And that tells you something about what that artist thinks is important in the representation of a human body and the representation of a human body that is also Peter Parker, and what kind of person he is and how his life as a person who wears street clothes intersects with his life as a person who wears a skin-tight costume. How does the costume differ to the things that he wears as a person on the street? Just keep looking and looking and seeing what you see and then thinking, what could that mean?
It's
the same process over and over again. It's just what is touching my brain? Why am I noticing it? Does it intrigue me further? Does it relate to anything else? It's just it's basically like Lego.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And as you're talking, it just makes me think about it. The more I've been getting into these spaces, I'm starting to figure out, I can kinda, I'm not gonna give myself too much street cred here, like, notice like the writers, I can start to kind of pick out like writing styles and art styles and the colorists, like the different jobs that go in there, and I'm starting to kind of figure out which ones I like more than the others. But now the question, as you're talking, for me is I want to think more about like why do certain styles resonate. You know, like the Spider-Man story is it's the same story over and over again, told a million different angles. But like the way people depict him and the things is
something with Spider-Man in particular. You mentioned writers. Spider-Man is known as a joker, right? A quipster.
Yeah.
So when you're reading different guys or people, I don't know how many women have ever written Spider-Man, but there must have been some, right? Anyway, the various people who write Spider-Man, the kinds of jokes they have him say, the kind of quips they make him give, are going to vary. Some people will have it all be sarcasm. Some people will have it all be pop culture references. It varies. And that's interesting. Why does that writer like that kind of thing? Why does this person think Peter Parker is the kind of person who would know whatever piece of pop culture? Does it tell you about the character, or does it tell you about the person writing the character? Mm. It varies, but both are interesting because they're both technically people.
Yeah, that is. Oh, it's so fascinating. God, yeah, that's so good. Yeah, now I'm going to have to go through and think through the different series that I'm reading and kind of pull through that there.
It's endless fun.
It is. I need to go back in my stack and start to flip through and see what I didn't pay attention to the first time.
Yeah.
You know, which is, it's so great. I love the idea of inquiry and wonder, and you're definitely sparking that through this conversation. And so, you know, which is so funny. I do want to be respectful of time. I could, gosh, talk to you forever. But this is so fascinating because the way we queued up this podcast was really not anything that we have been talking about, which has been such a wonderful delight. But I think it does fit into something that I at least do want to touch upon, because I think it fits into this whole ecosystem, kind of full circle of what we have been talking about, this idea of noticing and wondering and humanity and what it means to live and all that stuff. But, you know, when I was pestering you behind the scenes on social media to come on and do this show, I have been posting, and people know, like, I do a lot of like AI image creation, things like that. And you and I got into a just a good conversation. It was, you know, which was like, we just need to talk about this. And because you can bring a voice that I can't. I know it from my lens of what I do as a nerdy guy that likes shiny tools. And I know how to process implications of things that maybe we should think about in education. But we were talking about that idea of AI and the impact it could have on the creative arts, whether that's comics, it could be any of the things. I mean, we've seen the strikes in Hollywood and what that means for writers and creators and people in the room, where all of a sudden, if they're just editing AI work, like all of a sudden we lose a sense of that. We're seeing this here, and lots of court cases around just artists and musicians around the work that they create to being put into this. So I love that this whole conversation is not on AI, because that does get old. But I think the reality is that AI is forcing a lot of us to, in good ways, even though it's murky and there's no clear answers, to kind of reassess what it means to be human. But in this case, there are threats and maybe some risk and things that not everybody is thinking about. So I wanted you to get a chance to kind of share some of that stuff in terms of AI and the impact it could have on industry or creatives and things of that nature, because you can offer a lens that maybe not all of us have thought through, which could help us notice some other small/large things going on that maybe we should.
Okay. I guess I'll start with a splash page, like your average Spider-Man comic. AI is bad. How's that? And it comes from a few different directions.
Yeah.
First of all, and this isn't something I'm going to go into greatly because I don't need to, it's really bad for the environment.
Yes.
It takes a lot of processing power, like unreasonable amounts, and that not only takes up a lot of energy, but that energy has to come from somewhere. And it is ecologically damaging and does trouble the world's poor more than the world's rich.
Yes.
So bad. That aside, I suppose. It is being widely advertised as the solution to artists.
Mm.
It is being spoken of by many of the evil side of the tech boy fun-having demographic as, you know, anti-artist death. We don't need stinky old artists anymore. We don't have to respect them anymore. We don't have to pay them anymore. And that's great, is the the stance, which I think is quite horrible. Right. Because not only is that like obviously unpleasant, it's actively hostile. It rejoices in the economic destruction of a creative industry and the income of people who have devoted their lives to art and to producing beautiful and interesting art pieces and need to fuel their human bodies by buying food and so on. I said this when we were talking on Twitter, but a company that can fire all of its artists and just use an engine to recycle their old work into slightly adjusted new versions will do that. They right. are doing that. It's bad. Particularly because the reason that I brought it up to you specifically instead yeah. of just going on is you work in schools, you work with children, you've invited me to help inspire upcoming generations to artistic and creative work, and it won't exist if it's not protected. It will be gone. There will have been, in economic terms, no point in doing that if art as an industry is allowed to collapse, mm-hmm. is allowed to be attacked and actively reduced, demolished, denied by the people who want to make their money by using all of the existing art that has been done by real human artists and feeding it through a big weird machine to make new mosaics. You can just do that by hand. Like, that's allowed. You can yeah. collage, you can repurpose. But if you let machine do it, no one's having fun. No one's benefiting. Someone's losing their livelihood, and no one is using their mind or their heart or their eyes or their brain. They're just churning. So like in the third instance, like I said earlier, while you are alive, you have to do things. You have to do something all the time. And if it's never going to be art because it's not economically viable, or because you are too insecure, you feel you can't compete with the computer that is recycling other people's years of hard work and expertise, if you're killing yourself, you're denying your own fun, joy, creativity, time. It just is very gruesome to me. Like in the local newsletter, I live in a village now, so we have a local newsletter and like local plays on at the hall and whatever, and there's a poster in some of the windows in the shops and also in the newsletter for a two-man show, and the poster is done with AI. It's like regurgitated clip art of a sexy Frankenstein, and it's just incredibly sad to me that nobody was asked to have a go and draw sexy Frankenstein for this amateur dramatics. Like, why? Why not? Isn't it nicer? Isn't it more fun if everyone has a go? Like, isn't the point here having a go to entertain people, not just lurging out something stolen? It's just, like, sad and gross. And I don't mean to, like, I'm sorry to say that, because I know that you have enjoyed it. And I'm not saying that it's, like, I don't understand why it's enjoyable, because there's a certain occult interest in, like, the unknown, and in like some people enjoy getting Stable Diffusion to produce them an image and then like fixing it or adjusting it and so on, and like I understand that, obviously, because that is the editorial process. It's just, what's the point of doing the editorial process on something dead? Why not collaborate with someone who has done their best so far? Then you help them, then they do better. That's good, that's nourishing, that's life. But not doing it, or doing it on something that can't respond, that can't care, that can't be interested or really think about the changes you're suggesting, it's pointless. And like a slight tangent, but I promise it's related. One of my favorite directors, Albert Pune, was never particularly respected. He was in the latter half of his career, very much known as a trash creator. And in fact, in the last couple of decades of his life, maybe three, he had brain lesions. He was ill. He was dying. And his films suffered because of it. They're bizarre. They're strange. They don't make sense. They're not really, in like professional average terms, finished. But they're still fascinating and they're still inspiring and they provoke enormous amounts of thought in me because they are messed up results of someone who has trouble. Like, his brain isn't fully braining, but he's still doing it. He's still trying. He's still making things. He still has the confidence and the compassion and the kindness and the generosity to provide the world with these bizarre artifacts that have all the occult interest, all the, like, mysterious, that doesn't make sense, what could he have meant by that? Like, everything that's fascinating in the bizarreness of AI exists in human output. It's just outside of the very commercial, because the very commercial is carefully honed to be easy to understand and easy to apply and easy to enjoy. So, of course, it's not going to be quite as fascinating in quite the same way, because the editorial process has made sure that rather than being strange, it's comprehensible as a value. And that's fine. It's just that if that's all you're seeing all of the time, then seeing very strange, very mysterious, very confusing items may feel like a novelty. And it doesn't have to, because you can provide that novelty for yourself by seeking weird, by seeking low budget or rubbish or niche or cult. Like, I just watched The Fifth Corner. You said, am I binging anything? And I said no, because I forgot that that would count. But yeah, I just watched all five or six issue episodes. It's from 1992, I think. It's awful. It's the worst television show I've ever seen. It's genuinely very, very bad. It wasn't even all aired. It was cancelled after two or three episodes and they made more. But they were just like, no, it's not worth it. We're not putting this on the television. And they were right. It's dreadful. But because it's dreadful and because it's so obviously not ready for the television, for the commercial sphere, it's fascinating because you don't usually get to see that kind of thing because they usually rescue it in time and make it better or just throw it away. But being able to see this discarded item, like pick things off the rubbish heap, provides that same kind of interest. It's just, It does it with real human output and real trying and effort and attempts. Like, even though they technically aren't good enough, they're providing me with enormous value because I can see what they were trying to do and why they didn't manage to do it. And I can see the interesting ideas they did have that just never really got fully born. And anyone can do this. Like, it's genuinely not hard. It's just that most people don't get told that they should or can do it. And so it doesn't occur, because why should it?
Yeah.
So I'm saying now, go and find some rubbish and have a look at it, because it could be very interesting. It won't all be, but some of it will, if you allow it to be, if you look for the value, if you look for the freaks. They are there, honestly. They truly are. Freaks are everywhere, and they're great.
Well, I think thank you for that incredible answer. It reminds me, whether it's perfectly packaged by Hollywood and blockbuster films, I think what you just kind of captured there is the idea of the human spirit, right? Working through obstacles, challenges, setbacks to find some sort of triumphant ending, and not everything ends in the Hollywood way where there is, you know, we're the number one, we're the prize boxer if we're, you know, we're Rocky or whatever it might be. But those elements are what we're all grappling with. And it's so spot on. I mean, I'm looking at it through as you were talking, and like, I was listening to a podcast. It was Joe Rogan, which people can take him 18 million ways, but he was talking about Dave Chappelle's process as a comedian. And how he has, you know, the huge big blockbusters on Netflix and everyone, a household name if you're into comedy. But he says what people don't know is he works his craft all the time and he flies all over and just shows up at random comedy places. And when the show is over, he'll ask to go on stage with whoever left. And he's working on his ideas because they're not always good. We only see, right, the kind of shiny package Netflix special that just lands, you know, or if you're a fan of him, it lands and you enjoy that hour. But what people don't see and what Joe Rogan was talking about is like the countless pursuits and hours and dedication where when you are in that limelight, you can't be necessarily as freewheeling. So you have to do it in different ways. And that's kind of how he does it. And I was thinking about, we'll just keep coming back to comics, like, I've been exploring more independent comics and some of the podcasts I've been listening to have talked about how there's kind of been a resurgence outside of like the Marvel, DC heavy hitters, like some of these independents and the beauty of like, that's where new ideas come from. Like we know, I mean, we can take Spider-Man. I love him. I already know how every series is going to end, right? They're not going to like venture too far off the path with what Spider-Man Peter Parker is going to do. I'm still going to read it because there's comfort in the journey, right? Like there's comfort. Yeah. I know what I'm going to get each page. But the independent piece pushes the thinking. It pushes the art. It pushes what is maybe capable on a page. And I think about out of COVID when every single media company came out with their own streaming platform. And all of a sudden, you didn't know which one to subscribe to. And now it's cluttered and it's messy. And for me, it's frustrating. And so now they're all going to kind of be a conglomerate. But someone came up, was talking about the idea, like, but that's when so many new ideas were able to be shared. People were, they're all trying to pitch to be the best. But now there's shows that had you just had cable, or if it's just Hulu, or if it's just Disney, they're never going to make the platform. They're never going to make the recipe. But because there's so many of them, people are getting opportunities to share stories and medium and art, you know, and it just could be just countless examples as you've kind of talked about this. So there's something to all of that. And even getting to AI, like my hope that I'll get off my soapbox here is that with AI, as I dabble in it, I don't dabble in it, I'm in it quite a bit. What I'm seeing is that people, my hope out of AI is people are going to start to get so saturated in this AI recyclable content, the writing, the blog post, the art, the video, it's all going to, and that people are going to start to go, I miss the human side. I miss the sloppy. I miss the hand illustrated Frankenstein promo for the two-man show. I miss, you know what I mean? Like I miss the things I miss. And I think there'll be a resurgence. I think we all got to kind of just sit tight here. I hope. I mean, that's my thing, that through all this, it's kind of like a broken mirror complex. We look back at ourselves as humanity and go, boy, there's some things we overlooked and there's some things that we've got to clean up and maybe nothing else appreciates. And so that's my hope with all of things, even though I dabble in it quite a bit, but I start to see it. Like all the images look the same, all the graphics. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm calling myself out because you can go on my website and you can see it. Image AI image stuff everywhere. So I am calling myself out here, but I think it'll just be like, oh well, I gotta do something different because now everybody's doing it, right? You know, and so I think there's I hope a resurgence, a renaissance of humanity at the end of this.
Well, I think that you have a lovely optimism, but I would perhaps challenge you to see AI as your brown towels. Get out the scissors, Aaron. Get out the scissors and some old magazines. Cut and paste.
Yeah.
Practical image rearrangement. It's a good time, I promise.
It is.
Like, seriously, the same things that, like, the same results, comparable results, but a much more, don't laugh, spiritual process.
Yeah. No, I get it.
I want to see what you do.
Challenge accepted.
That's a genuine challenge.
I used to make like a monthly vision board.
Yes.
And I would just go to the bookstore and just buy at random. Sometimes I have my kids go and be like, just pick out 3-4 random magazines. And then that's what I would use to kind of figure that out. So,
fantastic.
I'll bust out my scissors and maybe make a trip to the, well, I don't even know if I even have bookstores around me anymore. I have to go find a bookstore, but yeah, I'm not cutting comics. I'm going to tell you that. I'm not going to cut my comics, but I will cut up some magazines.
They're never going to be worth a million.
Oh, come on. You know, yeah. Well, Claire, I am already, gosh, way over time here chatting with you. It is always such a deep, profound pleasure to speak with you, even if I get to sit on the sidelines of a classroom and watch you work the magic and bring these same kind of ideas to the level of kids as we're working through their own kind of self-identity and stuff to this conversation. I think is going to give lots of, I think, excellent thought for people to think about their own practice, seeing the world, what their brown towel is. And, you know, maybe that's the challenge. Everybody listening, let's see your own vulnerability and create something by hand and share it to wherever you come across this podcast. And so, Claire, this has been so good, so powerful, so thought provoking. For people that want to learn more about you, follow your journey, just kind of figure out what that is, we'll get all the links in the show notes. I know we'll get links to you mentioned the ebook and some different things like that. But, you know, I always like to end. Someone's sitting at a red light and wants to know more about Claire, you know, where's the best place for them to go?
ClaireNapier.com. Simple. Hey,
that's about as easy as it can be. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has just been wonderful and such a delight. And I always appreciate your authenticity and way of seeing the world. So thank you.
Thank you. I've had a good time. It's nice to be allowed to just run my mouth.
Chaos. Woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, chilling with coffee mugs, me and coffee chugs, talking education all across the nation, pushing boundaries, thinking innovation. Chaos.